Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, talknation.org for news and discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Monica Benderman joins us today to talk about her husband, Kevin Benderman, who received 15 months in prison after asking his commanding officers for conscientious objector status. Conscientious objector status, or CO status, is not easy to get in the military. Hundreds of soldiers had applied for it as of 2003. Thousands of soldiers also go AWOL, according to Mark Krall at the Center on Conscience and War. This is not something the military likes to talk about, but it happens more than you might think, he said. And as a general rule, it's easier to get out of the military than soldiers and others may think. For example, the military can't do much, if anything, if recruits simply don't show up for basic training. Recruiters may harass people. However, there really is little they can do to someone who has signed up but doesn't show up. There are a variety of ways that the center can help people who do not wish to remain in the military or who are trying to make a decision about becoming a conscientious objector. There are a variety of ways the Center on Conscience and War can help people who don't wish to remain in the military. Call 1-800-394-9544 for further information. That number again is 1-800-394-9544 for the GI Rights Hotline. Amnesty International considers Kevin Benderman to be a prisoner of conscience, imprisoned solely for his conscientious objection to the war in Iraq. Their August 9th action alert says, quote, Amnesty International considers his objection to the war in Iraq to be genuine and credible. The organization also considers that he did take reasonable steps to secure release from military obligations through filing his application. Kevin Benderman was convicted on charges of missing his brigade's movements under Article 87 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. He will also receive a dishonorable discharge and reduction of rank. His lawyers are appealing the verdict. Monica Benderman joins us today to talk about her husband and what he's trying to do. Monica Benderman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
The last time we talked, you were waiting to know what would happen to your husband, Kevin, as he had tried to get conscientious objector status and was struggling with the military. Now he's been given 15 months in prison. Why don't you bring us up to date first on what happened with his trials, what the culminating decisions were?
They found him guilty of what's called missing movement, which in essence is basically they're saying that he was assigned to a manifest to fly on a certain plane and he wasn't there to get on the plane. And so that's why he's spending 15 months in confinement. He was also found not guilty of desertion.
Now, that's got to be good news, at least some good news.
Well, certainly the sentence is far less than what it could have been. And, it, you know, obviously we look at it, and yes, he's confined, and then 15 months maximum. But that's the worst that can happen to him now. You know, that's when he's finished with his 15 months, he's out. He has done what he knows is the right thing for him. He took the stand that worked for him, and he didn't back down from it. And so the worst thing is that he's confined for at most 15 months.
Monica, we talked a little bit last time you were on the program about Kevin's reasons for doing what he did, for trying to become a conscientious objector. First, let me ask one of the more obvious questions. Now that your husband's in prison for 15 months, do you still believe that this stand you're taking is worth it?
Yes, without a doubt. And I don't think... You could tell in Kevin's face, even at the moment that they sentenced him, he didn't blink an eye. It's what he believes in with all his heart. It's what he knows is right. And there's no doubt at all.
I know a lot of Kevin's story strikes members of the military like him who have served, you know, several different tours of duty in various places. It has struck people as somewhat extraordinary for one reason or another. I mean, people have strong feelings about what he did. Why don't you go over some of what people have been saying that are also in the military? Because there are raw feelings, lives upturned. Are people, do you feel, in the military struggling with you? Do they accept you still? What's your experience like?
The soldiers that are close to Kevin, the ones that are here on post and have watched this entire experience, are behind Kevin, and because they know him and they understand that he's taking a stand for his conscience, for what he believes in. But they know too that the only way that they're going to be safe is for this war in particular to stop, and that's basically what Kevin is saying with his stand. They at first maybe have struggled a little bit with his decision, because we do hear from people, well, he had a duty, he left his soldiers hanging, he should have been there. That is something they brought out in the court-martial itself, that another NCO had to be trained in his position. But honestly, Kevin tried for almost a year to work with his command to try to get himself into a position first of non-combat status. He worked finally into a position that was in administration. He tried talking with his chaplain. He tried to give them notice and let them know, and they brushed it off. They took that stand and said, you know, we're not going to listen to you. You're balking. You're going to go. There isn't anything you can do. So we look at it that way, that there's a lot of the story that soldiers not right here that are aware of the circumstances they're not involved with it, so they don't know everything that happened. We understand their feelings. Kevin does, too. This is certainly not any way a statement on Kevin's part or my part that we don't respect soldiers, we don't respect the hard work they're doing, because Kevin has done that hard work, and he's been there. He knows what it's like. He just knows that right now, for himself, to bring the peace that he needs, and also to feel that he is doing something right for those young soldiers that served with him, he's got to take the stand that he's taking.
I did happen to see Tim Goodrich speak briefly during a rally that was televised on C-SPAN. Tim Goodrich has testified, actually, at the World Tribunal on Iraq, and I bring him up because one of the things that he said in the context of the discussion being the Downing Street documents that show that members of the British government and U.S. government met well in advance of their having gone to their respective governments, countries, to talk about the need for invading Iraq, that they met secretly, that they planned the war secretly, and that there was discussion about how to fix the intelligence, fix the facts, so that the argument for weapons of mass destruction would work, in advance of anyone knowing about what the U.S. military was doing or planning to do. A unit that Tim Goodrich was with that was in Afghanistan moved out, shipped out, and began to engage in strikes against Saddam Hussein's army in Iraq. And he described this as part of a U.S. military effort to either get Saddam Hussein to strike out at the U.S. military and provide a rationale for an invasion, or soften up the war zone for the pending invasion. And that is shocking news to those of us who thought the invasion was starting when all of the discussion was going on in the U.S. press. And that, of course, we heard right through 2003, discussion about whether or not the war was going to happen. And there were discussions, you know, at least some discussions on the part of members of Congress. But I remember how the president argued that he was giving Saddam Hussein every chance to provide documents, and then Saddam Hussein did provide documents, and then every argument having to do with the United Nations just seemed to come undone as this White House bullied its way into this war. So going back to what I heard Tim Goodrich say, here's a soldier who says his new mission now is to bring U.S. troops home from Iraq. And it really sounds as if between now and September, there will be a lot going on toward that end. Just talk about the larger picture of other GIs and of this new interest on the part of soldiers to bring U.S. forces home from Iraq.
I think soldiers are coming to terms with the fact that they're going to have to take care of themselves. I know that's what Kevin did. Going back to the discussion of the Downing Street memo, Kevin and I talked for pretty much the entire year of 2002 about what their mission was and what was happening. And from spring of 2002, Kevin knew Iraq was going to happen. He didn't know when or how, but that was the discussion with us. You know, we need to get together. We need to spend time together. You know, Iraq is going to happen. And that was clear from March and April of 2002 on with the soldiers at the 4th ID. Now, exactly what specifically they were told, I couldn't tell you because he never did tell me. But his comment was, we're going to Iraq. And as far as spending time together and getting together and let's get our lives organized because this is what's going to happen. So I have no doubt that they had a plan and that they knew what was going on. Aside from that, Kevin Stance really has to step over and above just this war because there are so many people that are speaking about the specifics and about the illegalities, which we are not going to dispute and we're certainly not going to deny. But the fact is, in Kevin's mind, what made him make the choice that he did was that I think historically, if we could look back in depth to past wars, beyond the depth that we have with the Iraq war because of the communications and technology and what's out there with the media and everything right now, we would find that no war is any different. It's a series of deceptions. It's people feeling that the answer is violence, that it's a matter of control, it's a matter of occupation, it's a matter of putting somebody down by force. And war is just such a negative thing. It's killing, it's destructive. There can't be anything about it that you could look at as being positive. And that's what Kevin's looking at, that we need to solve the problems of this war because this is where we are. This is the war that gave Kevin his firsthand experience that said, I will not be part of this anymore. But his first hand experience tied into what he knew from history, what his father in World War II had told him, why his father came home from World War II absolutely against war. All of that tied together to give Kevin the decision making ability that he had, which is, it doesn't matter, this war. If somebody attacked his home, I have no doubt that Kevin would defend it. If someone physically came in and violently threatened what was his, Kevin would take a stand and defend it. But he would do it with the means that he needed to make that stop. He wouldn't just randomly go out and just destroy everything to prevent it from happening. And that's the stand that Kevin's taking about this war. I think in talking to a lot of the soldiers from Kevin's unit since the decision of Kevin's court-martial handed down, from emails that I've received, phone calls that I've received from other soldiers, and listening to other soldiers call in to some of the radio interviews I've done, that's the way many more soldiers are thinking than people realize, that they're there to defend their country. They will defend their country as needed, but they want to be respected for the fact that they're trained. They worked hard to get to where they did in this United States Army. They may have come from difficult means. Some of them came out of violent situations to become soldiers. And the discipline that they learned in our U.S. military taught them restraint, taught them, you know, I can shoot center mass on a person and kill them. I can use karate and I can take them out. I can do all the things that they've been taught to do, but at the same time, they've been taught to use it with restraint. And yet now, their leadership has sent them into something where there's no restraint involved. And that shows disrespect for what those soldiers have done to create themselves into the kind of people that they are.
You spoke with Norman Solomon in a piece that appeared in Alternet on July 29th of this year. And in that interview with him, you said that it was hard work to face the truth. And I want to ask you, of course, this is true in a personal way, that it's hard for you and your family. I understand you have children and it's difficult. But what about some of the larger questions? And I know you think about them because we talked about them a little bit here in a previous interview. But here we are 60 years after the dropping of the atomic weapon on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And as you look at the possibilities and as you consider the whole cause for the war as it was described to fight terrorism, what goes through your mind now? Do you watch the news? I mean, tell us a little bit about how this argument has ripened for you in an international way.
I don't watch the news because I don't need to. It's not, we already know what it is. And, we can watch where it's going and be part of it, or we can sit and say, oh, no, here's more information. The information's there. We know what it is. To me, it's just a matter of acting on it. Anger, I think Kevin and I both felt anger a year ago, and there was commentary from us that showed that anger. But you have to turn it off pretty quickly, because if you get too angry, you're defeating the purpose. You're attacking with anger exactly what you're trying to stop, which is anger and violence. That's what it is. So you have to sort of reflect. You have to stop and reflect and say, it's going to be patience. It's going to take instruction. It's going to take a strong stand. I have to stand not as a pacifist, but as someone who will be an aggressive in seeking peaceful resolution. And that's by knowing. I know that what we have right now isn't working. Wars for 2,000 years haven't worked. Wars to resolve any type of conflict, all they've done is produce the next generation of people that have become quote-unquote terrorists, become gang members, become people that are willing to pick up a gun, put their bodies in the line of fire, blow themselves up. You know, so it's time. It's time to say none of this is working. Trying something new cannot possibly put us in any more difficult situation, so we need to try it.
Let's talk about this issue of truth and how we come to understand what's happening, because this country was lied to. U.S. soldiers were lied to. And now the administration seems quite unapologetic about that and has not offered another explanation as to why this war was necessary in their eyes. In the midst of all of that argument about what this war is about, do you find that you're called upon to argue about what the war was really about?
I'm not going to argue with them, and I do have a lot of people say, this is what we're going to war for, and what do you think? And that's all politics, and I wasn't there. I wasn't involved in why we went to war. I just had a husband that went, came home, said, I will not be part of it. What I saw is wrong. And basically, I have to say, war is extremism. That's what war is. And so we're attacking extremism with extremism. It would seem to me that the only reason that they have an excuse to be able to say that we went to war to counter terrorism is the fact that if you look at it, they didn't do what they were supposed to be doing. There was no personal responsibility for seeing that this country had the security and the protection it needed to keep anybody from coming and doing what they did that they're now using as a justification for this war. If we had had our system set up, if we had been taking care of things here, we would not have to go away to take care of terrorists, if that's what they want to say they're doing, to keep them from coming here. And that, to me, says something. The very fact that they're trying to justify this by saying we're going over there to take care of them so they don't come here. Well, so now you're telling me that you don't trust enough in what you've done to protect our country that we got to keep them out of here because heaven knows what they'll do when they get here. To me, all the money wasted on this war on terror, or whatever they want to call it now, would have been better served if they had accepted personal responsibility when they had been elected to office, when they had taken those positions, and they had done their job, and they had protected this country here at home. We don't need to go anywhere else to take care of anybody if we're doing exactly what we need to do right here in this country. If we're taking care of our families, if we're taking care of our people, if we're taking care of our citizenship, if we're putting our money where it needs to go, if we are truly building our police forces, that's what it's all about. There's absolutely nothing wrong with having a standing army that is prepared to defend their country. But it's doing nothing but weaken this country by putting the money in and sending that standing army to heaven knows where to fight terrorists that, you know, it makes absolutely no sense to me. Let's build up what we have here. Let's give our people not a sort of illusionary sense of security. Let's make it a real sense. Show them you're safe. People will make the sacrifice for a little bit of safety. It will cost us a lot less money in the long run. Our soldiers will be home. Their families will be cared for. We won't be creating a new generation of terrorists somewhere off in the world that are out to get us because of what we did. We won't be creating a new generation of hateful people here in this country because their dads aren't here to raise them, because they died in a war that makes no sense, because the dads and moms come home from that war that makes no sense and commit child abuse. Their divorce rates are up. They're out racing across, killing themselves in motorcycles because they can't cope with what they've seen. Everything about war, this war and any other, is nothing but destructive and dehumanizing. And people have to stop and think, you know, I'm sorry, I regret everything that has happened to the Iraqis. But it's happening right here in this country, too. It's happening with the divisiveness of our citizens over, is war right, is it not? Should I have my yellow ribbon upside down or right side up? It's happening in what's going on with our soldiers when they come home and the fact that they are not taken care of, their families are not taken care of, it's nothing but lip service. This war does nothing except destroy in all aspects of it. It's across the world. We don't have the respect in the world anymore. What good comes of this? Nothing.
We're talking with Monica Benderman, and her husband, Kevin Benderman, is presently in prison. He is serving 15 months for refusing to return to Iraq and asking to be given conscientious objector status. In London, when there were recent terror attacks there, we saw a fairly surprising number of people describe their emotions right after those attacks. And a number of people did say that they felt that the war in Iraq had led to what had happened. That's really brought about a new level of discussion. And at the same time, again, there are many reports that have been coming out. One from London, Chatham House. I'm looking at a State Department report. U.S. figures show sharp global rise in terrorism. This is a Washington Post article, April 27, 2005. Last year was bad. This year was worse. They're deliberately trying to withhold data because it shows that as far as the war on terrorism internationally, we're losing. And that's a quote by Larry C. Johnson, a former senior State Department counterterrorism official. If this military's sort of knee-jerk response is more militancy, more violence, stepping up the bombings, stepping up their aggression, what kinds of things can you say in response to that? In other words, have you been able to articulate for yourself a response to the increase in terrorism, and is it still this nonviolent approach?
It's just a matter of again, you have to go back to personal responsibility, and people won't try it because people don't trust themselves enough to be strong enough to stay committed to it. But when you take that stand and you say, I'm not going to be part of this, I will not use violence unless somebody attacks me in violence first, that person's going to think, when you take that stand and you hold it, if you're not attacking them, if you haven't done something, if their life hasn't created and been so far removed from what life could be, that's what a terrorist atmosphere and a terrorist environment is. Somebody that blows himself up, they don't care about their life here on Earth anymore. They don't have anything to live for. All the hope that they would have of things, if things were working in their life here, chances are they wouldn't put a bomb on their body and blow it up. But the fact is, they've lost a sense of this life being what's of value. This life, life well lived, that's where glory is. Glory is not in death. But they've gotten to where their mind is twisted in their thinking because there is no glory here. They haven't found the glory here. They're trying to reach out and trying to find a heroic act or try to find something in themselves that they can show for this life that they don't have, so they turn to the hereafter. Okay, if I do this and I die, I'm going to be glorified for having done this. That we have to get back to showing people the glory is in living your life well, in doing things, taking care of people, taking a stand, living for yourself, teaching your children to have hope, to have success, to work hard, to earn, and to feel good about what you've earned. But if we don't give other people that chance, and if all we're showing is we're going to take care of our own and we've got all these successes, and yet you go to these other countries where they don't have that, and they feel that desolation, they see the destruction, the more that's thrown at them, the more destruction that's thrown at them, the worse they're going to see, it's going to be a lot easier to strap that bomb on and to blow themselves up. Because where's their hope? We're taking it away from them. We're just going to continue to create more of that desolation. We're going to continue to create more people who are willing to put those bombs on until we say, stop, wait. Wait, let's rethink this. What is it exactly that we are creating? Is it a life well lived, or is it that we have the illusionary belief that there is glory in death?
When you think about what has happened in Iraq, what are some of the things that would come to mind about what might make Iraqis feel hopeless as far as the U.S. presence goes?
Pick up a paper and read it. You know, go to the internet and read what they say. I read an article yesterday about children in detention camps and the things that are happening to them there. There's 107, I believe, in detention camps, and they talked about some of the things that were happening to those children. That's hopeless. That was hopeless to me. I thought, my goodness, God, what is it going to take to read that article and to even for a minute think that someone could put it down in paper that there's a possibility that that is happening, let alone that it is happening? God, what will it take for people to wake up and say, is this humanity? Is this American humanity? Because if it is, I don't want it. And things like that, the very fact that one picture that stands out of the little girl from the checkpoint when her parents were shot, accidentally or not, the fact is that picture showing her with the blood on her, crying and knowing, I wanted to adopt her. I told Kevin, I want to find her, I want to bring her here, and I want to give her love, and I want to raise her. Because somewhere we have to stop, and we have to wrap our arms around these people, and we have to say, look, we care. Let me give you a hug, and let's find a way to work this out. Healing is going to take years, years and years and years. But we got to stop first, because every minute that we don't stop is that much more healing that's going to have to happen.
Monica Benderman, thanks for sharing your deep thoughts with us, and good luck to you in your effort to get Kevin Benderman, your husband, on appeal to see if you can get that 15-month sentence reduced.
Thank you.
Monica Benderman's husband will serve his 15 months in the brig at Fort Lewis unless his appeal is successful. Many groups and individuals are supporting him. BendermanDefense.org to express your support for what they're doing and send a letter to Congress. Representative Cynthia McKinney is going to enter the letters into the congressional record. Last week, we spoke with John C. Bonifaz, a Boston-based attorney specializing in constitutional law. He's been working to bring about the impeachment of George Bush because of what's contained in the Downing Street Minutes, afterdowningstreet.org. I asked John Bonifaz to comment on Kevin Benderman's sentencing.
Well, I think the position clearly is one to scare any others who would dare to have the courage of Kevin Benderman. I think he is an American hero for standing up against this war and facing the consequences he's now facing. But I think that there will be others who have the courage to stand with him and to protest this war. You know, this is a military, it is a volunteer army. Many of the people in the military, disproportionate numbers, come from poorer communities in our nation and are disproportionately African American and Latino. They join the military as a way out of an economic trap, economic oppression that they've been facing, and only to find that this military would be essentially privatized by the president himself and used for his own personal decisions, with respect to war and peace, without any approval, really, by the U.S. Congress and without any real authority under the U.S. Constitution. And these soldiers who signed up, they did so knowing that they would have to obey the commander-in-chief with respect to his lawful orders. But they also know, and the soldiers in our case knew, that they did not have to go to war for illegal and unconstitutional reasons, and that they had the right to stand up against any illegal and unconstitutional war. The commander-in-chief himself has the responsibility to obey the law just as much as the soldiers do. And if the commander-in-chief is engaged in violating the Constitution, then the soldiers have a right to stand up against that.
You've been listening to Talk Nation Radio. TalkNation.org for a transcript of this show and to discuss what you've heard here today. You can also read more of what Monica Benderman has to say at TalkNation.org. I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced at WHUS Stores, Radio for the People at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live.